This thing is... They never invented a good ear one yet. There we go. Now, we started out by the first three talks. I was asked to speak on three things, which it's the three things that I knew when I set out to write that big book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, against Christianity, to refute it all, that one, I had to show that the Bible was not historically reliable or accurate. I couldn't trust it. Second, I had to show that Christ never claimed to be God and there was no evidence to show it. And third, which I felt would be the easiest, I had to refute the resurrection. Wow, was that a tough one. In fact, I never could do it. And so the first night I dealt with the scriptures, second night with the deity of Christ, tonight with the resurrection. You can go to josh.org/resurrection. You can download all my transcripts. I mean, there's probably just in resurrection 400 PowerPoints and all free. The transcripts of all the different times I've given it and everything, you can download it all free. Just at josh.org/. The resurrection. Fact, fiction, or fallacy? I concluded a number of years ago that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the most vicious, wicked, heartless hoax ever foisted upon the minds of men and women in the world today. Or it's the most fantastic fact of history. Folks, it's one or the other. There's no in between. It's either the greatest hoax or the greatest historical fact. One of the two. And so I had to examine it. And, you know, you all know this, but I'm going to refresh your minds. But if there is no resurrection, Paul wrote, of the dead, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is vain and your faith also is vain. For if the dead are not raised, not even Christ has been raised. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless. Wow! I tell everyone, every time I meet some agnostic, and especially antagonistic agnostic, I'll say to him, you want to shut me up? All you have to do, only one thing you have to do to destroy all Christendom. He said, what's that? Show the resurrection never happened historically. I said, no, if anyone could do that, it's all silenced. You're silenced, I'm silenced. Our faith is worthless. Might as well believe in a mushroom if Christ isn't who he claimed to be. That's how critical it was. And I knew that this is what I called a cataclysmical decision. That's a type of decision for me historically where you have to make a decision. You can't walk away. If I walked away from this, I already made the decision to walk away. And so it's so clear that it was Jesus of Nazareth. He was a Jewish prophet. Oh. Bob back there's having a fit. I love electronics. There we go. Whoa, don't jump ahead. It was Jesus of Nazareth. He was a Jewish prophet. He claimed to be Christ, prophesied in Jewish scripture. He was crucified. 3 days after his burial, the women found the body gone, and his disciples claimed God had raised Jesus from the dead. And Jesus appeared to them several times before ascending to heaven. Now that's the historical claims of Christianity. They're either true or false. I could not find any in between. Why? The resurrection and the New Testament is what you call time-space dimension. You say, what do you mean? It wasn't something that happened off in the air somewhere. It's something that happened in the flow of history as we know it today. There was time. If you'd had a clock, it'd been ticking off. There was space. If you rubbed your hand over the cross, you probably would have gotten a sliver. And what I needed to realize, it's history as we know it today. I can't make myth out of it or anything. It's either historically accurate or historically false. one or the other. A man by the name of Dr. Simone Greenleaf, one of the most famous lawyers ever, was a key professor at Harvard. He wrote the three volumes on the laws of legal evidence, how you weigh in a court if evidence is good or not, used all over the world. He was challenged by some of his students to take his three volumes on the laws of legal, this was brilliant, of evidence, and to apply them to the evidence for the resurrection of Christ. I mean, would you have thought of that? I'm not sure I would have. I would now if I went back and studied, but that's genius. Well, he did it. Well, in the process, he became a believer. He went on to conclude that the resurrection of Christ, and you have to understand, this is one of the greatest legal minds in history. The resurrection of Christ is one of the best supported events in history according to the laws of legal evidence, which he wrote, administered in the courts of justice. And he became a believer, outspoken believer. And then there was a journalist by the name of Dr. Frank Morrison. He thought the lifestyle of Jesus was the most beautiful lifestyle ever lived. He thought it was a model life, but he was so irritated when he came to the resurrection because he felt the resurrection was not historical and it ruined the beautiful presentation of the life of Christ. So he took his own money and went to Palestine to gather information. He was going to write a book to refute the resurrection. Well, in the process of doing that, he became a believer. He went on to write a book that everyone ought to read. You can probably get it on Amazon, called Who Moved the Stone? And the first chapter is significantly titled, The Book That Refused to Be Written. Almost every great genius that I've read that set out to refute it ended up becoming a Christian. Those that took time to examine the evidence, they became a believer because the evidence, like Dr. Greenleaf said, the evidence is overwhelming. He was crucified. That meant, as the scripture brings out, that he was whipped with what they call a cat of nine tails. He was whipped. The cat of nine tails was made up of a handle about this long. I'm going to have one made so I can literally hold it, because when you see what it really is, it's terrifying. It had strips of leather come out from it that was wound into the end of it. And then at the ends, they wound in jagged lead balls or jagged pieces of broken bone. And each length, each strip of leather was a different length. Now why? Because if they were all the same length, then when they brought it down on the back, it would all bundle up. So if they had it at different lengths, all nine hit the body simultaneously. Ooh. And what they would do, they would bring it down on the back. And you'll see when they describe this historically. They would rip it down the back over the buttocks and down the back of the top part of the leg. And it literally, sometimes it so opened up the back that you could literally see the internal organs. And many, a good percentage, died from the whipping before they ever got to be crucified. Now, the Jews were limited by their law to 40 lashes. But the Romans were whipping him. So you know what I found out in research was, the Romans so despised the Jews that when they would always add 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more lashes to it to spite the Jews when you were whipping a Jew. When you consider what Cicero said, the Roman philosopher, he considered the death by crucifixion the most cruel and hideous of tortures. In fact, Will Durant, the historian, said even the Romans pitied the victim. In fact, Alexander Metherall, the MD and PhD, he said the pain was absolutely unbearable. He spent months just studying the whipping. In fact, it was literally beyond words to describe. There was no word to describe it. So you know what they did? They had to invent a whole new word called excruciating. You know what it means? Out of the cross. Ex out, cruciating, crucifixion. It was so horrible, they didn't have a word to describe it. Next time you use the word excruciating, realize it probably really isn't. Because what you're going through is nothing compared to what Christ went through. Then there was the furca. What in the world is a furca? What started out, remember it says that Jesus carried his own cross. Now what happened down through history, they would call it a furca. And it would be the crossbar where they would crush the grapes and everything, and they'd pull it like that. They would take that off and strap their arms around it. They would carry that. And then there got to be so many people crucified, they didn't have enough furcas. So then they would take the bar that was put in to lock the doors inside like a big room, a barn or something like that, and they would strap that around the person. And then it got so many more people being crucified, normally they didn't carry their own cross. They were strapped to the crossbar. And Christ was either strapped to the crossbar or he carried it over his shoulder. He probably, I would conclude, and it's no big deal, that it was probably strapped to the crossbar. Then it says that his hands and his feet were nailed against the cross. You know, we take that for granted. But all down through history, leave it to a Harvard professor. There's probably been no more professors more wrong than those out of Harvard. There's probably been none of them more right than those out of Harvard at the same time. But Dr. J.W. Hewitt said the New Testament account of Christ being nailed to the cross was false and misleading. And he wrote that in the Harvard Theological Review. Of course, everyone all over the world quoted him. It was thrown up in the face of pastors. He wanted to say, crucifixion by the use of nails was considered legendary, Harvard Theological Review, up until a dead man spoke out in 1968. Dr. V. Sepharis, an Italian archaeologist, north of Jerusalem, found four cave tombs near Mount Scopus. These tombs held 15 ossuaries, which were large jars. 15 ossuaries containing bones of 35 different individuals from one family. There was a man, one of the men buried was the name of Johann ben Hagagau. And it was in ossuary number 4 that they found his bones, but in with the bones with the 7-inch spikes. Isn't that interesting? Going back to about 70 BC to about 120 AD, dated. They found the spikes. And all of a sudden, they saw it was dated from about 2nd century BC to 70 AD. The moisture, when they locked it in, they locked in the moisture. Now get this, that preserved the bones. And they finally had to admit they crucified him with nails, driven through the hands, actually right here, the lower part, the wrist, so it wouldn't rip out. And then the body preparation. In John 19:39-40, Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes. Myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial customs of the Jews. Now, I would estimate there was probably, well, I'll get to that with the next slide, 100 pounds wrapped. Now, normally what they would do is they would wash the body. They had to close the mouth because no water could drip within the mouth or that person would be cursed. Not the dead person, the person that dropped it. No water could fall on the floor. If any water fell on the floor, the people who was washing their body were cursed. And then they wrapped him in three separate pieces of linen cloth, weighing about 117 pounds with the myrrh, the aloes, the cement consistency, and the cloth. They would start below their feet, wrapped to their armpits, and in between the folds, they put the spices with the cement consistency. Then they'd take another piece, they'd stretch their arms down, start below the fingertips, wrap to the neck. Then, because they always had to use at least three different linen cloth to do it, that was required. And they would often put what was called a, not a face cloth, but a strip around to hold the mouth closed, and then a separate piece with the linen in between it, a jaw cloth, and a separate piece wrapped around the head. But you say, 117 pounds, come on, Josh, that's a lot of spices. Well, when Gamaliel, the grandson of the great Jewish scholar, when he was buried, he used 86 pounds of spices. In fact, when Herod died, they said it took 500 servants to carry the spices. So 100 pounds wasn't out of the ordinary for a great leader to be buried with. And it fits in with history. And then you've got the tomb he was buried. From the moment a body was removed from the cross, Jewish law mandated it must always be touched by two people. One person was forbidden to carry the body. It always had to be two people. And was put in a cart, two people had to be touching the body at all times. And they would place it inside the tomb. Now, most tombs had an entrance about 4.5 to 5 feet tall. And inside, there was kind of a table, a hewn out of rock table, where they would stretch the body out on it. And that's where they would then prepare the body and the clothing and wrap it. Now, with the linen cloth, there could be no ornamentation or stain on the cloth. Second, it had to be sewn by women, Jewish women. Third, no knots were permitted. Why? Because they believed the cloth represented the continuity through eternity. And so they couldn't have knots, couldn't have linen, anything else. They had to be sewn together and then wrapped around the body, because one piece wouldn't be enough unless they were sewn together. Let me skip ahead here just a minute. Then it says, a large stone was rolled against the entrance of the tomb and laid it in his own new tomb, that was Joseph, which he had hewn out in the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. In Mark 16:4, it says the stone was extremely large. Extremely large. Now, how big was a large, extremely large stone? I was lecturing at Georgia Tech, and the third night it was on the resurrection. And a number of professors were there, and they went on a tour of Israel with Tech for one purpose. They went and took the size of stone used in the time of Christ, and they calculated out as engineers the weight they would have to weigh to close an entrance of 4.5 to 5 feet tall in a cylinder. And they sent me a letter. Oh, I wish, I don't know what happened. I've got it somewhere. I just can't find it. But they wrote it all out. On the back, they gave all the detail in perfect English. Said Josh would have to weigh 1.5 to 2 tons minimum. That's why it was called an extremely large stone. It said, he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb. Critics say to me, now come on, Josh. How in the world could one man, Joseph, roll a large stone against the entrance of the tomb that weighed 1.5-2 tons? Well, it's something I learned. You never apply upon any document of history that is not probably true in your own time when it comes to literature. Today, what was the analogy I just had happen to me? I forget what it was, but they said, I was in South Africa debating on Ahmad Didat, and I asked Didat, because there were like 5,000 chairs out there. Or I asked one of the other people, I said, who in the world brought all these chairs in? And he said, Didat did. Now, was he meaning that Didat personally lifted every chair? No. He had many people helping him that did it. But today, you refer to one person, even though it might be 30 people. And there they said, well, Didat brought him in, meaning he was in charge of it. That's how don't force anything on history that you wouldn't today. Joseph could have had 20 people with him to roll that stone. But then, this is what I believe happened, is very simple. Yeah, you can see how the entrance of the cave, and then to the right of it, it's usually a little more slanted up. There's a trough there that runs up the side. The stone is placed in there, and a wedge is stuck in the stone to hold it. Then when they put the body and everything else, all you had to do was roll over, pull out the wedge, and the 1.5-2-ton stone would roll down. They had an impactment on the other side. It would hit it, and it was all sealed. When a child could do it. And so don't impose things upon history. You don't impose upon reality today. It easy could have been just Joseph. Or he could have had 20 people with him, 19 women and one man. And they all rolled the big stone up against it. The Roman guard. This is one that was mind-boggling to me in my research. In Matthew 27, so we request that you seal the tomb until the third day. This will prevent his disciples from coming and stealing his body. And then telling everyone, he was raised from the dead. He was talking to the Roman governor. The disciples were and said, if that happens, we'll be worse off than when we were at the first. So Pilate said, take guards and secure it the best you can. It says they took the guards. They took the guards and they sealed the tomb. Now, when they refer to the guards, they used the Greek word custodian. That was a specific word for the Roman guard unit. A Roman custodian. A Roman custodian was made up of 16 men. I don't think I've ever been more fascinated with research than when I researched this all out, because I'd never heard it before. I never heard anyone ever describe the custodian in books or anything. And so I was blown away. And each man was trained to protect 6 square feet of ground. The average custodian had, it was either 4 or 5 weapons on them. They used psychological warfare. You ought to read the opponents when they would describe it. They had these massive helmets, and on top of the helmets, they had black and purple feathers go up a new 2.5 feet. Why? When you read the writings of their opponents, they said at a distance, they looked like giants. And so they used, that's pretty smart, psychological warfare even with it. And 16 of these men. Now, normally, from what I understood, They were broken up into units of 4. And so one unit of 4 would be placed right in front of the stone, protecting it. Then the other 12 would be resting or asleep with their heads pointing in and their feet pointing out. And then every 4 or 6 hours, I think it's 4 hours, they would wake up another unit of four, and then they would guard and go. And they said the reason they did that, no matter what time of day, if something happened, the entire 16-man unit was rested and ready to. That's pretty brilliant. But the Romans were when it came to military. And then it said this, along with a guard, they set a seal on the stone. The seal was made up of two pieces of rawhide, four clay packs on the outside to attach it. And in the center was a large clay pack in which they would take the Roman seal and embed it into that. And the seal was not to make it harder to get in. Anybody could break the seal. The seal was an authenticating device that when the guards put the seal on there, they put their lives on the line that what they were to protect was there. And people feared the breaking of the Roman seal. The Roman seal was broken. The FBI, CIA, the NSA were thrown in to find it, men or women. And there were two ways. One, they were crucified upside down, or they were burned in a fire started with their own clothes. But it was always death whenever they found the person or people that broke the Roman seal. And whenever they sealed it, trumpets would blow whenever they used the Roman seal all over the land. Why? Reminding the people of the authority of the Romans and what that seal stands for. So everybody was aware of it. Now that was the pre-resurrection scene. That's what it looked like ahead of time. Now the post-resurrection. Ay, 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 Chihuahua. The post-resurrection scene. The stone is rolled away. In Matthew it says, and behold, a severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven, came and rolled it away and sat upon it. And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothing as white as snow. The guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. And the angel said to the women, do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who has been crucified. He is not here. He is risen. Just as he said, come see the place where he was lying. And he said, go quickly, tell your disciples. And he went and said, he'll meet you in Galilee. Probably Jesus told them ahead of time, but they didn't understand the resurrection. So he told ahead of time a place to meet in Galilee. And so Jesus was reminded, remember our meeting place in Galilee. Now, in Mark 16, very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen in the morning. They were saying to one another, now these were a small group of women going there, who will roll away the stone for us? Now that was a logical question. Who will roll the stone from us from the entrance of the tomb? Now that was logical. They said, who will roll away the stone from what? The entrance of the tomb. Why? So we can go into the entrance. Now keep that in your crawl. The Greek word to roll, is kuleo, K-U-L-I-O. In Greek, as in English, to change the direction or intensity of a verb, you can add a preposition. The first time they went there, in Mark 16:4, Mark added a preposition ana, which means up or upwards. Anukaleo means to roll something up a slope or an incline. Because Greek is so specific, for them to have used anukaleo, there had to be an incline coming down to the front of the tomb. It doesn't say how steep, but there had to be an incline to have it rolled up an incline. And then, in Luke 24:2, he used the same root word, kaleo, but added the word apa, A-P-O. Apa means separation from or a distance from. Apa kaleo means to roll one object from another object in the sense of distance or separation. Then, in John 20, verse 1, now you got anakaleo, up a slope away from, apakaleo, removed in a sense of distance. But look at this one. They use the word iro in John 20, verse 1. Iro means to pick up something and carry it away. That's the only thing it can mean. Greek is so specific. And said they iroed the stone. In other words, that stone was in such a position it looked like it had been picked up and carried away up a slope. Away from, but away from what? I think I have this in my notes here. I don't know. I have so many notes I can't keep track of them. When the women were going there, remember they said to each other, who will roll away the stone from what? The entrance of the tomb, which was logical. But when they got there, they changed it from the entrance to the, they used the word for the entire massive sepulcher. It was separated up a slope like it binged up and carried away from the sepulcher, not the entrance. That stone had to be up a slope in such a position away from the entire tomb that it looked like it had been picked up and carried away. Otherwise, Greek makes absolutely no sense. Whew. Where am I here? There we go. The tomb is empty. Let me ask you a question. It was about 6 minutes into research on that I realized this. Whenever you learn a new truth, don't you get excited about it when all of a sudden you, I never knew that. I get so excited because I love to learn. And I got quite excited with this when I realized what would have been the hardest place on earth for the apostles to go and preach the resurrection if Christ had not been raised from the dead? Jerusalem. Now think of that. Not Galilee. Jerusalem. A 15-minute walk by a skeptic could confirm the tomb was not empty. Did you ever think about that? I hadn't for a long time. I was probably 3 months into being a Christian before I realized it. Jerusalem had been the hardest place in the world to go back and preach the resurrection. When somebody says to his wife, stay here, I'm going to go check it out. I'll be back in a few minutes. Hey, wait a minute, Paul! The body's there. Dr. Ron Sider, I believe he's passed away. He was a historian. The thing I liked about Ron, he was so practical. I read a lot of people and they use these words and everything. I said, what in the world does all that mean? With Ron, he made things so clear, accurate, but simple. And was like reading a novel when you wrote history that he wrote, Dr. Ron Sider. And Ron said, if Christians and their Jewish opponents both agreed that the tomb was empty, and they did, we have little choice but to accept the empty tomb as fact. Look at the appearances of Christ. In Acts 1:3, after suffering by many convincing proofs, appearing to them over a period of 40 days. Now that's key, folks. They didn't say 4 hours or 4 days. They said, for 40 days, they lived with him and walked with him. And the New American Standard phrase is, with many convincing proofs that he'd been raised from the dead. That phrase in the Greek means with overwhelming evidence that he'd been raised from the dead. For 40 days, not 4 days, not 4 hours, 40 days. No way he could have pulled off an hallucination on that one. For 40 days, they said, we were with him. With overwhelming evidence. We ate with him, we walked with him, we did everything, we talked with him. He taught us for 40 days. They'd been raised from the dead. And then it says, he was seen by Peter and by the 12. And he was seen by more than 500 of his followers at one time. And then it says, most are still alive. Do you realize when Paul wrote that, he put his entire life, his message on the chopping block? He said, most of whom are still alive, though some have died. If any of them were alive and they had not seen the resurrected Christ, Paul would have been lucky to have stayed alive. And then it says, and then he was seen by James and later by the apostles. And then he says, last of all, I had been born at the wrong time. I also saw him. Appeared to Peter, to the Emmaus disciples, to his disciples, to his disciples, to 500 believers at one time. Now think of this. 500 witnesses. Give each one of them eyewitness testimony in the court of law. Give each one 6 minutes. That'd be 3,000 minutes of eyewitness testimony. That's 50 hours. There's probably never been any court in history that's had 50 hours of eyewitness testimony by 500 people. Paul put his whole message, his life on line with that. Went on and on and appeared. At Oxford, there were two friends, Gilbert West, an author, and Lord George Lyttelton, a statesman. They were determined to destroy the basis of the Christian faith. So Gilbert West was going to prove the fallacy of the resurrection. Lord Lyttelton was going to prove the fallacy of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus to the Apostle Paul. So they left the university, went their own individual ways to do their research. Then they were going to come back and write a book together to refute the very foundation of Christianity. And so when they returned, they were a little sheepish to share their findings because Gilbert West concluded that the resurrection was true. You want to read it when he says, it took me a little while to get that out. Well, then, Lord Lyttelton said the conversion apostleship of St. Paul alone, duly considered, was of itself demonstration sufficient to prove Christianity to be a divine revelation. And they both became believers. And what was the book they wrote? Oh, I don't have my notes. I haven't thought about them for years. Look at the validity of the witnesses. They were eyewitness accounts. Said, what we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also. But then in the university, I always knew it was coming up. Every classroom I'd ever speak on history and the resurrection. And they were usually history classes. They would say, look, Josh, Jesus only appeared to his followers, to friendly eyewitnesses. And that comes up all the time. I can hardly wait. And I said, really? Yeah. He never appeared to anyone that didn't believe? No, he only appeared to friends. Oh, really? Well, that's interesting because Saul of Tarsus, he hated Christ. Paul was such a pure Hebrew, he truly believed that Jesus was a false Messiah. And he would literally went from city to city trying to get people to incarcerate all of his followers. But Saul of Tarsus, like his father, possessed Roman citizenship. And Paul said, last of all, as though I had been born at the wrong time, I also saw him. Well, he's the only one. Well, what about James, his brother? James, his brother, was anything but a believer. He was embarrassed with Jesus going around doing the things he did. He was embarrassed with saying the Messiah, the Son of God. But he appeared to his brother, to James. And James became a follower of his brother, became a key leader in the church, and one of the first martyrs for his brother. So please don't tell me he only appeared to friendly eyewitnesses. Just the two offsets all the others with Paul and James. There's several theories that I've heard all the time in universities. And one you always hear, no matter what country, what culture, what university, the wrong tomb theory. Say, well, they were emotionally upset and everything, and they didn't have a clear understanding, and they went to the wrong tomb. Well, I guess then you'd have to say that Joseph of Arimathea went to the wrong tomb. And you have to say the women went to the wrong tomb. The disciples went to the wrong tomb. Then you have to say the Jews went to the wrong tomb. Then I guess the Romans went to the wrong tomb. And then I guess you have to say the angel went to the wrong tomb. And then the whole world went to the wrong tomb, and they still are. If you believe that, you're as blind as somebody standing outside today and saying, I can't see the sun. S-U-N. Then this is the big one. I'm right on time. Not going to be, I have Q&A, but I'm right on time. John said, if you don't close at 8:15, we're not bringing you lunch tomorrow. Gary, I mean. I love you, guy. We go back years, don't we? Yeah. The hallucination theory. Oh, I hear this all the time. This is one that Christians hate to hear. And yet it's the easiest answer. They say, well, they're all emotion and everything, and they had hallucinations. Well, the American Psychiatric Association says a hallucination is a false sensory perception. Now, read these carefully. A false sensory perception in the absence of an actual external stimulus. The psychiatric dictionary says an apparent perception of an external object which when no such object is present. And then another dictionary says an apparent act of vision for which there is no corresponding external object. And another encyclopedia observed results a hallucination is a result from purely psychological causes, not from the presence of an actual external object. Do you get it? No two people will ever have the same hallucination because it's all internal, emotionally. There's no external trigger. There's no external object. It's all internal. So for two people to have the same hallucination be as great a miracle as a resurrection. And then to say 500 people had the same hallucination with no external object or anything else, and then went out and died for it? It's a private event, a purely subjective experience void of any external reference or object. That's why no two people have the same hallucination. Now think of this. If all 500 had the same hallucination, it would be a greater miracle than the resurrection itself. Then I'll wrap it up with this. I'm just going to mention it. Circumstantial evidence. That's not direct evidence. It's circumstantial, what you can draw from the circumstances. One, the church. The entire history of the church was founded in AD 30 based upon the resurrection. Without a literal resurrection, you cannot account for the church the way it was founded. Second, Sunday worship. On the first day of the week, when we gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them. And what they did, they switched from Saturday to Sunday. Why? The day Christ was raised from the dead. That's when they worshiped him. But here's the thing. Boy, I got chills thinking of this. You take any, in all of history, any group of people who thought there was a tremendous fear if they made the wrong decision, it was the Jews worshiping on Sunday. Because it was automatic death, breaking the law. Now you think of that. They had that hanging over their heads. They had to be so convinced that Christ was raised from the dead, they changed worship from Saturday to Sunday, from the seventh day to the first day. I think that's one of the most powerful decisions anyone ever made in history. Then, believer's baptism. I mean, come on. Believer's baptism is a symbol of the resurrection. It's a symbol of the crucifixion of Christ, going into the tomb and coming back out. And then, last, where do we go here? There we go. I almost said circumcision. Communion. Woo-hoo! Oh, no. Ah, erase that one from the tape. Holy Communion. Every time we take communion, it's honor of what? The death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. Without these four things have no meaning without the resurrection of Christ. There's no meaning. He is risen. He is risen indeed. I remember the first time I said that sitting in my dorm room at Talbot Theological Seminary. It's probably about 11 o'clock at night. And that's when I really grasped it. I was a believer. But that's when it hit me. It's on solid ground. He is risen. He is risen indeed. You can go to josh.org/Josh Talks, resurrection, whatever. You can download everything free. So two things here. Is there a pastor present here? Is there anyone in the back? I got two sets of two different notes here. Anyone could use a set of my notes in the back? In the front? Hey, Emmanuel, come up here, young man. No, Emmanuel. He put his hand up first, I saw it. Why don't you share one of these with him? They're two different talks. Why don't you give one to him? Then you'll really be God with us. The other, I got it over there. No, I got it in my pocket. I want to say this again. Did anyone or their children say they lost some money at the tables over there, the three tables in front of the main area? I found some money. It was wrapped up in a little paper like a kid had it all wrapped up. And there was some money, quite a bit of money in it. Well, if you know anyone that did, or anyone listening somewhere else, or somebody from Chicago, if you dropped it and the little birdie took it over here, you let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to give it to Moody. They need all the money they can get. Because what a program. Folks, please take to heart what I shared tonight. And I've learned one thing. If you take your notes, whatever, and you review it, you remember it longer. Don't let too much time go by, Because we're supposed to be ready always to give an answer for the hope that is in you. And you raise your children that way, and you almost never, ever lose your children spiritually. Never. If you raise them with convictions, we mean knowing what you believe, why you believe it, and experience it in your life. I look forward to tomorrow night. I've always been one of the biggest fans of Moody. But when they asked me again tonight, because the first time I spoke on it, they didn't know what I was going to speak on. At Moody Founders Week. Were you there for that? Oh boy. 5,000 people dropped their front jaws, and then they went with about a 15-minute standing ovation when it was over. And they've asked me to give the same talk I gave there. It's on pornography. I wish to God I never had to talk on it. In the most evangelical, fundamental, born-again churches, 52% of all the pastors are addicted. That's why most pastors won't talk about it. You probably never heard a sermon on it or a talk. I say, any pastor, look out over the congregation. Look at all the men between 16 and 34. At least 70% of them actively pursue pornography in the internet in the most evangelical church in the world. Of the women, 58%. Actively, not just once in a while, oh, it popped up. No, actively seek pornography in the internet. If we do not solve that, it doesn't matter how many Moody conferences you have, we'll lose. Doesn't matter how many great biblical sermons you preach, we'll lose. And we're losing right now. I believe we have 5, maximum 6 years to turn it around. Or the global church of Jesus Christ will be marginalized. And you see why tomorrow. We'll be marginalized. So, I'm really going to enter tomorrow night with a lot of prayer. But I'll tell you this, folks. If I had a son or daughter, for me, I would do it if they were 11 years old. But most people don't raise their children the way I raised mine. By the time my kids were 11, they knew more about sex than 95% of graduating seniors in university that year. People say, well, they're too young. I don't want to talk about that. Silence has never helped anyone to stay pure. Do you realize that? Silence has never helped anyone stay pure. You know what it is? It's knowledge. And that's biblical. It's knowledge that helps a young person stay pure. And if I had, now that's me, if I had an 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 child here, I would take them out of youth group tomorrow night. I'm probably not supposed to say this. I'd bring them here. Because it can open up doors of conversation between you and them for months to come. But I leave that with you. But I look forward to tomorrow night. Thank you again. Let's pray. Father God, thank you that He is risen. He is risen indeed. Amen.